This podcast is brought to you by BetterHelp. Welcome to Beg to Differ, the Bulwark's weekly roundtable discussion featuring civil conversation across the political spectrum. We range from center left to center right. I'm Mona Charon, syndicated columnist and policy editor at the Bulwark, and I'm joined by our regulars, Damon Linker, who writes the Substack newsletter Notes from the Middle Ground, Bill Galston of the Brookings Institution and the Wall Street Journal, and Linda Chavez of the Niskanen Center. Our special guest this week is economist Noah Smith, who writes the Substack newsletter No Opinion, highly recommended. All right, welcome one and all. Topic one, I want to talk about the Trump nominees and about their various difficulties. And then I'd like to, if we can, please remind me to get back to the larger question about whether it would be best for the country if people could just get what Trump wants for them and that there's no opposition and that the Senate maybe even goes into recess and just says, fine, recess, appoint them all. We won't block you. The voters deserve to get what they asked for. But before getting to that, let's start with Pete Hegseth, nominee for defense secretary. At first, he was getting quite a lot of pushback from senators, specifically Joni Ernst. Last week on the show, Bill Galston mentioned Joni Ernst as a potential bulwark against Hegseth. She folded this week in a pretty obvious way. And I think it's important to recognize that the effort that was made to get her to fold. She was threatened. She was her offices were bombarded. She received all kinds of pressure from the MAGA universe, and now she's saying that she's looking forward to not shepherding his nomination, but she said something along the lines of, you know, this is going to happen. Linda, what was your reaction?
Great disappointment, as you might imagine. I mean, this is a woman who has been sexually assaulted in the military. She seemed to be very concerned about his history. Of course, there is the one assault that is at least alleged and in which he paid a payoff to. But his whole attitude and the way in which he treats women, the way in which he sort of cycled through wives, I've probably made the joke before, I'll make it again. I think one of the chief qualifications of being a Trump nominee for the cabinet is you have to have at least three spouses under your belt. And I think, you know, it does say something about him. So I am very disappointed. But worse than that, Mona, is this preemptive kowtowing, not even putting up a decent argument on these nominees. And we're seeing it in the media. I mean, we're seeing it everywhere. Clearly, we saw it before the election with, you know, people like Zuckerberg and Bezos and others, LA Times editor, refusing to endorse. But this is not the way it's supposed to be. It doesn't mean that you have to have a million people in pink hats in the streets when the inauguration comes or after it. But it does mean that serious people have to look at these nominees and judge them by the standards we have always judged nominees by. And that is clearly not happening.
Noah, some of these nominees are fine. Marco Rubio for Secretary of State, you know, Doug Burgum for Interior and whatever other portfolio he was given. He was given something extra, I think. that's normal. But many of these nominees are not unqualified. They're anti-qualified. They are the opposite of what you would want in those posts. And I think right now, you know, of Tulsi Gabbard as Director of National Intelligence, who is a security risk herself. Nevertheless, some people are saying maybe the only way to get the attention of the American voter is to let them let it go. You know, just don't fight it and let voters see the results of their choice. What do you think?
Well, I think that in the case of Tulsi Gabbard, this, you know, the just let her do some damage and let Americans see the damage is not a good idea. And the reason is because, you know, Tulsi Gabbard, as director of national intelligence, has the potential to, say, compromise our entire national security by giving our intelligence to the Russians, which yep. I think there's a fair chance that she would do. And she's the real threat of all the nominees, more than Kash Patel or Pete Hegseth or anything else. Tulsi Gabbard is the real threat. She's being very quiet herself. She doesn't have personal scandals. So, you know, people think that she'll get confirmed because of that. But when you criticize Trump's nominees on Twitter, on X, you can criticize Hegseth and Patel and whoever, RFK, all day long. But if you criticize Tulsi, a massive number of suspicious accounts will attack you. And that tells me they're the one that they fear not getting confirmed. So that's the you know, key package they're trying to slip in is Tulsi. You know, Hegseth isn't gonna turn over our defense establishment to the Russians, and Patel isn't gonna, like, I don't know if Patel will be enthusiastic about rooting out Russian spies, but I think that that's less important. I think that Tulsi as director of national intelligence will be the huge win for Russia. And so that's the one that the pro-Russian people are going to try by far the hardest to get through. So she's the real threat and a real, you know, foreign affiliated mole in our national security establishment potentially. So then I wish people were more scared about Tulsi. She herself is being very quiet and not saying, you know, sort of provocative things in public and flying a bit under the radar. But people need to know that's the one. It's not Hegseth or Patel. So that's my first thought. My second thought is that when it comes to, the other thing about Tulsi is that if our intelligence gets compromised, Americans aren't going to know it for a while. You know, the average American won't suffer negative consequences for a while of having our, right. all our intelligence handed over to the Russians, to the ex-KGB, right? Like they're not going to suffer from that. It will, the chain of causality between that and the regular American suffering is very long. And so Americans mm-hmm. won't be able to connect the dots even if and when it does happen. However, on RFK, I think the opposite is true. I think on RFK, people need to see how stupid the new Republican approach to vaccines and to other public health things is. And, you know, they need to experience cacistocracy. So I would say, you know, and also note that they've appointed Jim O'Neill as the deputy secretary, continuing a pattern where they appoint, you know, sort of a crazy loyalist as the secretary and then a reasonably sane person as the undersecretary, you know, the deputy secretary. And so I think that that could go one of two ways. Either RFK is a figurehead and Jim O'Neill runs the thing, which is certainly true in like Britain and Japan, you know, the vice minister is the real minister. Or RFK does crazy stuff and he gets his anti-vax ideas implemented and people suffer and then they get to see what's wrong with electing people like Trump. And so I think that, you know, RFK should be, you know, his dirty laundry should be aired, but ultimately he should be confirmed because, you know, like the American people need to see that. But Tulsi is the real threat and needs to be stopped.
So, Damon, there's even more reason this week to be highly aware of the nature of Tulsi Gabbard, as we see these absolutely horrifying images and stories of Bashar Assad's prisons being emptied. The scale of brutality and savagery here is on a par with the Holocaust and, you know, the Khmer Rouge. I mean, you know, you name it. And this is a regime that she went out of her way to defend and to justify and to downplay the threat from.
Yeah, I mean, I to be perfectly honest, I you know, obviously I have no apologies to make for Assad and his regime. I don't know. my concerns about Gabbard are in a way broader that I just don't see any evidence, even apart from questions about why she seems so strangely pro-Russian and you know, issuing defenses of Assad's regime that go far beyond what one would expect from a kind of simple realpolitik realist. You know, I did not support intervening in the Syrian civil war more than Obama did. So someone who wants to, you know, say that, that was the right move, I actually might agree with. But the problem with her, and we saw some stories of leaks this week, from Republicans in the Senate who have been sitting with her in interviews, that she is actually like not impressing them at a more fundamental level, that she doesn't appear to know what she's talking about. She seems just utterly like unqualified to hold a position like this. And I don't know if people fully appreciate what this position is. We are talking about a position very high above a total of 17 agencies across the executive branch, including the CIA, the NSA, various intelligence gathering operations within the Pentagon, including Navy intelligence and so forth, and then in other agencies and departments of the federal government. It is essentially putting her into a position of being the boss of all of these agencies. And you should never, regardless, again, of like questions about her loyalties and why she has the judgment she does, I see no evidence that she possesses the expertise and managerial ability, even remotely enough, to be in a position like this and to be making judgment calls about, you know, what intelligence coming from which agency is worth listening to and highlighting for the president versus ignoring and kicking back down the chain. I mean, these are very practical issues. And it's very clear that Trump sees her, like RFK, as a kind of sop to what he sees as a kind of populist realignment. So like these two are former Democrats who supported his campaign, and therefore they deserve a reward in order to lock down this sort of new coalition that he's tried to put together and that he sort of successfully did in this election, kind of a coalition of anyone who hates the system from right to left. And, you know, that is a really, I think, irresponsible criterion to use for major jobs like this. It's just not supposed to be done. So, I very much hope she goes down. And on your broader question, just briefly, since we might not get back to me before we move on, I don't for a second think that Congress should. It's a different question from whether they will, but they should not roll over and give him what he wants. That is not, I mean, talk about, you know, pre-surrender. You know, like, I hope we get to Christopher Wray for no good reason I can see whatsoever deciding he'll just let Trump get his FBI nominee rather than actually saying, no, if you want this, you're going to have to fire me and deal with the political and institutional blowback from doing that. I see the whole process with all of these nominees as kind of on par with that particular issue of the fact that we have a system, and advise and consent is a fundamental linchpin of it. And if we decide to like let, if the Senate decides to go into recess and just let Trump summarily appoint whoever he wants, that is the kind of thing that is a much bigger problem than does Trump pursue X or Y policy that's bad on its merits and will lead to bad consequences. And a much worse thing even than like letting RFK, if RFK happened to actually become head of HHS, to let him, you know, implement some of his anti-vax stuff, which would be terrible, believe me. But those things can be changed with the next president, and we can try to clean up the mess. These deeper structural issues of whether presidents need to submit their nominees to review by the legislature is a much bigger change in the structure of our government in the direction of a kind of authoritarian executive. And I very much do not want to see that become the new norm. So that's where I stand on that, at least.
Okay, thank you, Bill. I think it's even... well, just to pile on a little bit about Tulsi Gabbard, it's the way her mind works. She has this tropism toward conspiracy minded thinking. She has embraced the talking points of the Kremlin. She said, for example, that the U.S. had, you know, a series of bio labs in Ukraine, and this is one of the reasons that the Russians really felt like they had to invade, which is total Russian propaganda, disinformation. She on a number of occasions, she has taken the side of the autocrats, the brutal dictators. She put out the idea that it was the rebels in Syria who were using poison gas on civilians rather than Assad. You know, so she, her mind is, in my opinion, does not work right. And it doesn't work right in exactly the same way that RFK Jr.'s doesn't and Donald Trump doesn't, that they are of a piece in the in terms of their conspiracy, their embrace of conspiracies and inability to sift fact from fiction. So that's all by way of piling on and just asking you whether you agree with Noah that it's best to let RFK Jr. do his worst, because then the voters will see the actual consequences. But that when in the case of someone like Tulsi, the damage will largely be hidden from view, at least for a while, and therefore it's worth doing a full court press to prevent this person who is anti-qualified, who is an obvious national security risk, from getting that position.
Well, we've reached the point in this conversation where I have to tell my favorite Mo Udall story.
Yes.
Okay. You know where I'm going, Mona.
I do.
at any rate, to make it short, you know, Mo Udall, a veteran and a veteran legislature, renowned for his wit, was sitting next to a freshman congressman as the debate droned on and on and on. And finally, the freshman congressman turned to Udall and said, "Why is this debate continuing? Everything has already been said." To which Udall famously responded, "Yes, but not everybody has yet said it."
Yes.
So that's the situation that I find myself in.
Okay.
I don't have a lot to add, particularly with your, you know, pile on in the guise of a question. But I will say that I am opposed to both of them. Quite vehemently, but for different reasons. We've already explored the probable consequences of Tulsi Gabbard's confirmation as DNI. But let's not forget, we could be facing a situation, you know, another pandemic in the next 4 years, where once again, we'd have hundreds of thousands of lives at stake. And I don't believe that Americans should be allowed to die simply because they made a poor choice on November 5th. That's a little bit too much for me. I think that at some point, a measure of paternalism is justified, and that is that people should be saved from the worst consequences of their mistakes, especially when it's a matter of life and death, and especially when the people who die are not necessarily the people who were in favor of this administration or this nominee in the first place. So I'm sorry, I think there's room for reasonable discrimination among these bad nominees, but I'm opposed to bad nominees for different reasons appropriate to each.
Mona, could I just offer one other thought and interested in other people think this. Right after the Tulsi Gabbard nomination came through, I was talking to somebody whose work in anti-terrorism has had the very most top secret clearance. And he was not as bothered by this as I expected. And the reason was that he said it's a kind of a non-position, that all of the intelligence agencies do their own things and are directed. And this is sort of the filter that in terms of what gets to the president. But we already know he doesn't even want to hear his security briefings. I mean, we went through that the last time around. So my question is it possible that she will be in there? Yes, she could leak secrets to the Russians. That would be obviously very, very serious. But in terms of having an impact on policy and the way the intelligence agencies do their jobs, will she really have that much impact?
My biggest fear is that there is no intelligence agency that could deny her anything.
Well, that's true.
She sits on top.
Yeah, that's true. She will have access. And I think that's the single most. But she seems to me dumb as a rock. I'm sorry. And who knows whether.
I don't know. I don't assume that. No, I think she's a little addled and doesn't think clearly, but I don't think she's stupid. Your nighttime temperature has a big impact on your sleep quality. If you wake up too hot or too cold, we highly recommend you check out Miracle Made's bed sheets. Miracle Made sheets are inspired by NASA and use silver-infused fabrics that are temperature regulating to help you sleep at the perfect temperature all night long. Also, traditional bed sheets can harbor more bacteria than a bathroom. It can lead to acne, allergies, and stuffy noses, and it's just gross. Miracle Made offers a whole line of self-cleaning antibacterial bedding, such as sheets, pillowcases, and comforters that prevent up to 99% of bacterial growth and require less laundry. So these self-cleaning sheets are infused with silver, prevents 99% of bacterial growth, lets them stay cleaner and fresher, three times longer than regular sheets. Also, they regulate your temperature so you don't wake up too hot or too cold. More than that, you don't have to sleep on bacteria, which can clog your pores, causing breakouts and acne. Sleep clean with Miracle. Miracle Made sheets are luxuriously comfortable without the high price tag of other luxury brands and feel as nice, if not nicer, than sheets used by some five-star hotels. Go to trymiracle.com/begtodiffer. To try Miracle Made sheets today. And whether you're buying them for yourself or as a gift for a loved one, if you order today, you can save over 40%. Use our promo code BEGTODIFFER at checkout. Miracle is so confident in their product, it's backed with a 30-day money-back guarantee. So if you aren't 100% satisfied, you'll get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiracle.com/BEGTODIFFER and use the code BEGTODIFFER to claim an additional three-piece towel set and save another 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/begtodiffer to treat yourself. And we thank them for sponsoring this podcast. I think we should move on because we have another really important topic to get to, and that is this cultural moment that we are experiencing with two people who were responsible for somebody else's death, because I'm not going to actually call Daniel Penny a murderer. He wasn't in the same way that Luigi Mangione was, allegedly. But this moment where Penny was acquitted by a jury in New York and Luigi Mangione becomes a cult hero for the cold-blooded assassination of an innocent man, a health executive, has caused a lot of comment. Damon got us rolling last week, noting even then that it had already started this adulation toward Luigi Mangione. So I'm going to start with you, Noah. some people like Adrian LaFrance in The Atlantic are saying, you know, this is what de-civilization looks like when people just celebrate this kind of raw violence. And there's no mediation. There's no sense that, well, of course it's wrong to kill, but I mean, people are just outright valorizing these acts. Now, by the way, I should stress, I said it, but let me just stress, what Daniel Penny did was controversial. Some people think he knew what he was doing and he shouldn't have held the chokehold for as long as he did. Others think he just didn't realize and it was kind of a manslaughter, not a murder situation. But whatever you think about Daniel Penny's actions, they're not the same as getting a gun and shooting someone in the back. All right, go on, Noah.
Well, yeah, I mean, I looked at the Daniel Penny video and I read about the case a little bit, and it seems like he was doing a reasonable thing to restrain the guy, and the guy accidentally died. And it seems like he did the right thing, you know, and it just turned out bad by accident that the guy died. But I think the jury, agreed with that. And I think that there have been like a few people who have claimed it's racist, you know, online. But I think overall people concur with this, with how the verdict came down in this situation. Whether or not his prosecution at all was a function of politics or blah, 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 is something I have no idea. So I can't get into that. But I think that people are generally satisfied with the way this turned out and that he's not a murderer, clearly. The crazy guy who shot the healthcare CEO obviously is a murderer. People celebrating that is kind of messed up. I think, the reason is that it's a... We're just coming off a time of unrest. I think that, starting in maybe 2014 or so, Americans, national pastime became political fights on social media and just social cultural fights. And social media caused, took this country, which was this big, broad, sprawling country that contained multitudes, that contained all these different people who had sorted themselves into like-minded neighborhoods and towns and companies and hobbies and whatever. And it threw them all together in one or two rooms, Facebook and Twitter. And that's a recipe for disaster. And it caused everyone to realize how, their differences with each other and scream at each other. Also, the platforms, realized that screaming optimized for engagement, which got them money. And so we had a time of unrest because of that, and mental health declined precipitously, especially among young people, especially among young women, and especially among young progressive women more than anyone else. And so I think that you have to understand this sort of like online, support for this murderer in the context of that, of the decade we just went through, and of how much it destabilized our society and the mental health crisis it caused, which ultimately was a technological, thing resulting from mass social media. I'm not happy about the fact that people are online cheering some murder, but I'm also not very surprised because, this certainly isn't the first time I've seen something like this happen over the last 10 years.
Bill, one of the things that was noteworthy about the reaction is that some people initially saw it as a left-right issue and thought that this was left-wingers cheering the death of a big CEO of a huge corporation. And Ben Shapiro tried to frame it that way. And he got terrible pushback from his viewers who said, here's the headline he put: "The evil revolutionary left cheers murder!" Exclamation point. And some of his own viewers said, "No, both left and right are cheering." And I'm not buying this left versus right stuff. They didn't say stuff anymore, Ben. I want health care for my family. And just because the left likes something doesn't mean you have to instinctively hate it, etc. So what do you make of this? We can all come together around celebrating a murderer, right? This is what's going to unite America, Bill.
Well, seems to be doing a better job of it than just about anything else that's been tried in a while. But look, let's get serious. What these two events have in common is that they triggered discussion of broad-based public ills that normal processes had left unaddressed. I mean, the backstory on the New York subways, and I actually took a look at some of the statistics about disruptions and violence, et cetera, on the New York subways in recent years. They've gone up by 50%.
Yeah.
People are scared, and they don't believe that subways are adequately patrolled and policed. And under those circumstances, when someone takes matters into his own hands, it's frankly not all that hard to understand psychologically why there might be public approval and a perhaps an element of jury nullification in the outcome of the trial. And similarly, I take all of your points about the difference between what Penny did, you know, and what Mangione did. You're absolutely right. However, the reaction to all of this reveals a near universal frustration with the tactics that big insurers have used in order to try to hold down their costs by denying or delaying or reducing claims. And I actually think that the Democrats missed a big populist opportunity by not going to war against the insurance companies. And I don't think they're going to make that mistake again, because in fact, I can tell you in my own family, my wife, who's had some serious health issues recently, is going slightly crazy, trying to keep up with, the denials, the delays, the revisions, the appeals, the request for more information, you name it.
Yeah.
So, both of these cases have, featured, I would say, perverse public reactions, but underneath them is the reality of problems left unaddressed by the normal system for too long.
So, Linda and Damon, I'm going to ask you to indulge me for just a second, because Bill raised a point that I want to get Noah's reaction to, because it deals with the economics of the situation, and we have a certified economist with us. And it strikes me, listening to Bill, Noah, that we have adopted a system, not consciously, but sort of by that we've stumbled into a system where, I mean, everybody rations healthcare somehow. Some people do it by price. Other people do it by government fiat. We do it in a way by all of these delays, denials, and added levels of bureaucracy. It's a way of rationing care, right? And doesn't it make more sense to use a price system or a tax system or some other system? Not that we're going to get there, but I'm just curious about your reaction.
Sorry, can you clarify the question a little bit?
All right. Do you agree that the way our healthcare system is functioning right now, basically, in order to stay in business, the insurers who don't have the hugest profit margins are attempting to delay care or deny coverage or whatever as a way to, smooth out their costs, and that is driving people crazy, and that there are more efficient ways to do it.
Yeah. So, our insurers operate close to the razor's edge of profitability. The typical health insurer makes a 1-3% profit margin. The average S&P 500 profit margin is around 12%. So you're operating, when you're at the razor's edge of profitability, a bad year can just devastate you, a couple bad years. So what do you do when you're at the razor's edge of profitability? You have to, take extreme measures like denying people's claims. So insurers deny people's claims to stay alive, you know, and maybe they could cut some costs, whatever. Some people have said, oh, well, they make a decent return on equity. It's lower than average, but it's not like zero. But the point is that return on equity doesn't affect your survivability as a business. Profit margin does. And so what this means is that in order to stay profitable, those companies have to deny you people coverage. Now, what would make more sense in terms of financially, but might be a larger burden administratively, is to partially deny coverage, as in, you know, say there's some, you know, leeway in the percent of things they could cover, so that, you know, people will get some percent of their thing covered, but it won't be, you know, like, it won't be as high. So it spreads the pain, so you don't get these people who just get their coverage completely denied and who then end up going to medical bankruptcy. It would be more humane if they did that. It would also make more people mad, because then right now, I don't know, maybe 3 to 5% of claims get denied. So, and you know, of course, a lot of those were just misfiled claims in the first place. But the true number of people getting just opportunistically denied claims is pretty small, but it's devastating when it does happen. So the correct thing to do would be to use risk sharing to spread that risk across everybody. But then the point is that a lot of people would encounter insurance companies seemingly arbitrarily denying them part, like some of the dollars, and increasing their bill out of pocket. So that would make more people angry. The problem with insurers is it's a shitty business, and the incentives are bad, and it makes people really angry to interact with, because they're sort of hired to be the bad guy of the healthcare system. Whereas the providers, the hospitals, you know, the pharma companies, whoever, they just give you whatever you want and assume that then you'll hate the insurance company for it. It's sort of like the, you know, 23-year-old McKinsey consultant that a company hires to tell them it's okay to fire all the people they were going to fire anyway. And so
that is so helpful. Yeah. Thank you. Okay. Linda, what's your sense of,
I'm sitting here wildly agreeing with Noah. Look, particularly in the health insurance business, there is such a huge disconnect between the companies that are providing the benefits and the customers. The customers, in the case of American health insurance, are not the people who pay the premiums. They are the companies that those people work for. And I think Obamacare, in an effort to try to deal with the, you know, health crisis and try to make sure that more people were covered, put in effect these rules like you can't deny somebody for a pre-existing condition. Well, guess what? If you have a pre-existing condition, your healthcare is going to be much more expensive. And if you can't charge somebody more for that, or you can't deny them, it's going to have an impact. And I think that's what we're seeing. So I think there is huge frustration. I've always thought it was absolutely crazy, and it's an outgrowth of, you know, something that happened in World War II, that labor unions, you know, ended up, they couldn't get raises, so they decided, well, let's get healthcare benefits for our members, and then that became very almost universal. So I think all of this exacerbates the problem. But I want to get back to your first question, and that is, you know, how did we end up here? Why is it these people are becoming heroes? This is the populist response. This is the populist movement. And I think when you see the sort of ultimate worst case scenario for populism, you see this kind of violent response. And I think that's what you're seeing, not in the Penny case so much. I think that a little bit, in the sense that people are really fed up with what they encounter on the streets, and the kind of fear that they have in taking the subway or walking down the street, you know, with homeless people or drug addicts or others who impede their way. So I think, unfortunately, I think we're going to see more of this. And it's very scary. And it isn't a left or a right phenomenon. I think it is a kind of when populism goes crazy moment.
Damon, when it came to the Penny case, I could think of parallels in history. I mean, the Bernie Goetz case in New York, where, I mean, it was actually much worse, because there he wasn't just attempting to restrain a violent person. He actually pulled out a handgun and shot four people. And he became a hero at the time. to some. And the case of Mangione, who, by the way, may have had a psychotic break, I don't know, but there's evidence to suggest as much. But in his case, you know, I thought of, it made me think for a little bit about OJ, you know, and how there was this huge outpouring of approval for OJ when he was on the run. People were standing over, you know, the highway saying, run, OJ, run, and being ridiculous and, you know, just appalling. And I thought, well, yeah, okay, but that's because he was a sports hero and a movie star, and you could maybe, you can't really understand it, but maybe. But this guy was a complete unknown who happens to be apparently nice looking. But he was a complete unknown who gets a gun and murders an innocent person in the middle of Manhattan. I have to say I was a little hard pressed to explain the reaction in any way that doesn't say we're in decline, folks. This is a really bad sign for our civic health.
Yeah, I mean, I guess taking the longer view, I mean, I'm glad that you brought up things like the Bernadette's case and some others from the past in the kind of medium past. But like, you can go back to John Dillinger too. Like, the Americans have a tradition of valorizing the kind of outlaw hero, a sort of scrappy, sometimes murderous Robin Hood. And I think, you know, there are all kinds of ways. This is kind of a theme of my comments on the podcast sometimes about how we're kind of back to the late 19th century. And there, I do think there are all kinds of ways, not just in the fact that we, for the first time since Grover Cleveland, have a president who was president, lost, and now is going to be president again. There are just a lot of parallels that I think point to the fact that, a lot of the things that I think everyone on this podcast probably admired and liked about the post-war period of this country are showing up perhaps as sort of anomalies from a deeper continuity that we are reverting to in a way that is potentially very distressing, because it is a kind of deep populism in American culture, a kind of let me bring in like more concretely, like I think some people online, like the poor, lamentably mentally ill Taylor, what's her name?
Lorenz. Taylor Lorenz.
And Taylor Lorenz, who, you know, not only is a journalist, but has been a journalist at the absolute peak of the journalism world, being wooed and working for the Times and the Washington Post over the last decade. She's at the kind of cutting edge of like valorizing Mangione as a true hero and almost like fangirling over him. Like, oh, how can we watch the trial? The trial? This isn't going to happen for like a year. What are you talking about? And there is some of that online, and I think a fair amount of it can be kind of dismissed as crazy online, you know, pathology. But I've been struck just in my daily interactions with people, not people calling this guy a great hero and admiring him, but exactly this line of course it's wrong to murder someone, but... Mm-hmm. And that's really what we're talking about, which is this sense among a lot of Americans that this system that we have is not the way it should be. It should not be that this guy was earning $10 million a year to be the CEO, plus perks, of course, to be CEO of this massive company that makes its money by, at least for a portion of claimants, rejecting those claims. And sometimes people die or suffer terribly as a result of those decisions. And that there's a kind of vague sense that people have through their own experiences, like Bill with his wife, And then much worse cases where people are much needier and less able to pick up slack when claims get rejected, end up in a situation of really hating this, that this is just unjust. This is inefficient. This is not the way it should be. And so they sort of get it. And that points, I fear, to a kind of a path that the Democrats are going to be confronting here over the next couple of years as they decide how they're going to go in to 2028. Are they going to do something, the kind of standard response, which would be proposing healthcare reform of this kind or that, or instead will they be populists? And it isn't populist to say we need to fix the healthcare system and come up with a new bureaucracy and maybe some fees or taxes to pay for it. Being a populist is demonizing health insurance companies and the people who run them and proposing to throw them in jail and saying other very irresponsible, even worse things about them in a way that probably will never happen, but that will whip up voters to vote for mm-hmm. them. That's what we've seen with Trump. And I fear that there's going to be a big temptation to try that. And when it does start happening, if it does, then we truly will be in a populist moment where we will have left-wing populism, maybe led by an AOC, running for president against a right-wing populist. And then the options are going to be bad one or bad two, at least from my point of view.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. And I detect, and I'd be curious if anybody wants to comment on this. There seems to be sort of mumblings among Democrats post-election that, you know what, Trump has shown that the voters respond to demagogues. And so the only answer is we need to get our own. I mean, I do worry that that is going to be a strong, strong temptation and will lead us to no place good. Anybody want to comment? Yeah, Noah.
Yeah. So I actually have a little bit of a counterintuitive take here. I don't think we're in a populist moment right now. I think we were for a decade. And I think that has basically faded. I think we're in a moment of dissatisfaction where people are upset, but you don't see people pouring into the streets. You don't see a ton of activism. You don't see, Trump's rallies were just absolutely filled in 2016, and they were, kind of empty this time. People voted for Trump, but just voting for Trump because you don't like the way things are going is not necessarily populism. That's just standard electoral democracy. I think that, saying populism as an opposite of elitism, I don't think that is necessarily the right frame. I think that sometimes people are dissatisfied with the status quo. The people being dissatisfied with the status quo was much bigger in 2008. We didn't call that a populist moment. It was much bigger in 1992. We didn't call that a populist moment, right? It was much bigger, I would say, in 1980. And we didn't call that a populist moment either. And so I think that...
Well, because the politicians who benefited from that dissatisfaction were not themselves populists.
Exactly. And I think that the fact that we're calling it a populist moment is because of who we assess that Trump is, not because of the actual energy that brought him into power. 2016 was a populist moment. I'll give you that. And from around 2014 to 2021, the era of unrest, I would say regular people really got involved. Now you don't see anybody at these Palestine protests. It's like this tiny fringe. Like nobody's like activism, leftist activism is basically dying off. You don't see like rightist people aren't as engaged in politics as they were 10 years ago, 7 years ago.
There's no Occupy Wall Street. There's no anti-globalization demonstrations.
People are tired. They're tired and grumpy. I think tired grumpiness and the fact that people slightly accepted, one unpalatable alternative over another unpalatable alternative in the recent election, that does not a populist moment make to me. I think that the fact that Trump you know, sort of downgrades expertise in favor of loyalty. This is, you know, it's corrupt, it's cronyism, it's kakistocracy, it's a bunch of other bad things that we want to talk about. Populism, I think, is not necessarily the right frame for this, because I don't think it was a grassroots surge of popular pro-Trump energy that brought him to power this time. Mm. And I think that's worth thinking about a little bit.
Yeah, agreed. Very, very good point. Let's take a moment to talk about mental health. We all have struggles. Some of us have more struggles post 2024's election, but they don't have to control us. Therapy can be so helpful. It's not just for people with serious trauma or major illness. We all need a sympathetic, dispassionate listener, someone with experience and perspective who can reassure us that others have the same insecurities, doubts, and fears and have managed to overcome them. Therapy helps us to figure out how our own minds may be holding us back. Ruminating about our worries and conflicts or the many balls we're trying to keep in the air at once doesn't help. It just contributes to the stress. And self-medicating with booze or drugs is a dead end. Therapy can help unwind your worries and let you be a calmer, happier version of yourself. If you're thinking of starting therapy, BetterHelp is a great option. It's incredibly convenient because it's entirely online, flexible, and suited to your schedule. You just fill out a questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and get started. If that therapist isn't a good fit, you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. It's the gift you give yourself. And we are coming to that time of year when you're thinking of gifts for everybody else. Think about yourself. Make your brain your friend with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beg to differ today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/beg to differ. We were going to get to Syria. I don't think we have enough time if we're going to also do our highlights and lowlights in a more relaxed fashion. So I will just open up the floor. If anybody has some things that they would like to say, they're very, you know, keen to say about Syria, please take this opportunity. But I'm not going to go around the horn for everyone. Anybody have? Yeah, Noah. And then Bill.
I'll let Bill go first because I just ranted.
Okay. Yeah, Bill.
Well, I guess what I'd like to say is that this is a peculiarly dangerous moment because politics, like nature, abhors a vacuum. And what you have in Syria now is pretty close to a vacuum. And we're going to discover very shortly that the people who surged into Hama and then Homs and then Damascus agreed on the importance of ousting Bashar al-Assad, from power and, and either killing him or driving him into exile. But that's where the agreement stops. And the Israelis are bombing away, not because they want to seize Syrian territory, but because they're terrified that chaos in Syria could lead to weapons falling into exactly the wrong hands, leading to an attack on Golan, et cetera. That's the silver bullet explanation for what they're doing. And if there was ever a time, where the great powers or the medium powers have been involved in the country and now ought to find a way of sitting down and trying to bring a modicum of stability to a very strategically located piece of territory, that time is now. And that will mean, among other things, the United States sitting down with the Russians and the Turks to try to figure out the way forward and maybe getting some of the other countries in the region, except Iran, involved in this discussion, because allowing things to take their own course, I think, could produce chaos that's even more dangerous than what we were looking at.
Noah?
I think that, to me, the what we're seeing in Syria, it's an important geopolitical development, obviously. I think it represents a a Turkish victory over Russia and the continuation of the Turkey-Russia rivalry is something that is underrated, that people don't think about enough. People think about Russia versus the West, all these things, but Turkey versus Russia specifically is something people should remember. Is it
Catherine the Great?
Catherine the Great. And that also this is part of what was going on in the Crimean War. And so in some sense where, you know, I think the Crimean War might not be a terrible parallel for where we are today with Russia and what it's trying to do. And people should think about that a little more. But that's not my main point. My main point is that seeing the joy and elation that has come from people experiencing freedom in Syria, which may not last. There may be radical factions may take over. That happens to revolutions sometimes, or you may see continued disintegration of the country, blah, blah. Those things may happen. But to see that moment of freedom should remind us that freedom is important. And ultimately, that's why we care about Ukraine, not some sort of pissing contest with Russia. It's freedom. You know, Russia wants to make Ukraine unfree, and Russia's made its own people unfree. And this is the contrast we draw between ourselves and China, that America is a much freer place to live than China. And that's why people want to move from China to America, not the reverse. That over the past decade, we have seen so many attacks on the idea of freedom. The idea that, you know, freedom was just a sham for George Bush to start wars, or, you know, freedom just leads to social media chaos and whatever, and riots and things like that. We have seen a real turn against the idea of freedom, and you don't see American politicians talking about it much anymore. The Democrats talk in terms of justice, and the Republicans talk in terms of greatness. Greatness versus justice. I would like to take door number three, which is freedom. And people need to talk about that explicitly as a goal more. And so I'm going to write a post with a picture of Braveheart at the top, saying, you know, we need to remember the importance of freedom. Syria should serve as a reminder, but I hope that over the next decade, we remember this core value that we used to talk about all the time.
Thanks. I could, underline in black ink. I couldn't agree more. And it's also a reminder of some of the worst evils the human beings have ever endured have been at the hands of overweening states. There's a tendency on the left to focus on, you know, the evil of big corporations and, that sort of thing. And that happens. And that's a problem in some situations. But when you have an autocratic state like this, the number of people who simply disappeared, they had no rights, their families had no idea what happened to them, there was no judiciary that they could appeal to, it was pure autocracy, and the level of sadism that this unleashed in the overlords is off the charts. And it's worth remembering that controlling state power should be something that unites freedom lovers the world over. Because this is what it can become. Obviously the US is not in any danger of becoming like Syria, but it is the extreme end of what states can do to their people. All right. Let's turn now to our highlight or lowlight of the week. And we'll start with Bill Galston.
Well, for me, the lowlight of the week has been the support that the conservative intellectual leader, Jim Pearson, has gotten for his campaign to defund the National Endowment for Democracy. I am trying to spearhead the defense and organize an opposition to this very dangerous and counterproductive move. Noah talked about freedom. Amen. No organization in the past 40 years has done more to promote freedom around the world than the National Endowment for Democracy. And no, Mr. Pearson, its mission did not end when the Berlin Wall fell and the Soviet Union collapsed. Those were the major threats then to freedom. But the idea that they haven't been replaced by other threats is so contrary to fact that I hardly know how to begin the counter argument, except open your eyes and take a look at what's going on, buddy. Okay, I should stop before I expatiate, but words really fail me.
Yeah.
You know, when
Bill, I don't know about Pearson in particular, but you know, what I've seen on a lot, part of a lot of right wingers is that they never actually believed in freedom at all. They simply were anti-communist, but they weren't pro-freedom.
That's correct. Yeah. They are a cynical lot because Ronald Reagan believed in freedom.
Yes, he did.
And he sure didn't. And he gave the speech that launched the NED. I've gone back and read that speech, and it wasn't just about the Cold War.
Right.
I'm sorry.
Right.
He's a great Cold Warrior, but it wasn't just about the Cold War.
Yep. And Reagan, by the way, pressured some of our allies to be more democratic, like the Philippines. Okay, Linda.
Hear, hear. Both you and Bill, Mona. I have an article from one of my new sources of information. I've mentioned I try to keep my eye on what's going, at least on the slightly right of center folks. And there was an article I thought was terrific in the Free Press this week. It was about Pete Hegseth. Why does Pete Hegseth keep talking about war fighters? It was written by Elliot Ackerman, who is a much decorated former Marine. But it really fits into the thing we're talking about here. Because what Ackerman is writing about is, you know, not some of the things we've, you know, already talked about with Hegseth. It's more about the way in which he envisions war fighters, as he calls them, and what his idea of what the culture of the military should be. And what is very clear is that it is a culture that is in conflict with the Uniform Code of Military Justice. And that is what differentiates the West, and other nations have similar codes, but it certainly has differentiated the United States. We fight wars under certain rules. Warriors are held to certain standards. And one of the standards is you don't sadistically murder civilians. And Hegseth was at the forefront of getting pardons for three men who served and who were in fact responsible for killing civilians or desecrating their bodies after. And it's really terrible. And it's sort of frightening in many ways to think about the role he will play in the military on that front. He wants to get rid of the woke culture, but he wants to put in its place the kind of warfighter culture that is antithetical to the values of American and our American military.
Thank you for that. Yes, we should keep in mind that his great contribution to our society over the last 4 years has been to lobby on behalf of our war criminals. So great. That's just great. Damon Linker.
There were so many options for lowlights this week. I didn't even know what to say, really. You know, there was Christopher Wray's, pre-surrender, which I mentioned earlier. There was Trump nominating Carrie Lake to head the Voice of America, which is like a pure troll move. There is like no way to take that seriously. It's just turning everything into a joke. But my actual choice is a highlight about a low light. This was a good piece that friend of the pod Yasha Monk had on his Substack, which is relatively recent that he's launched that separate from Persuasion, which he also is in charge of. This is a piece titled "When Democracy's Defenders Turn into Its Grave Diggers," and it's about the bizarre news about a week ago that between the first round and second round votes in Romania's presidential election, the nation's constitutional court decided to annul the first round results because a right-wing populist named Calin Georgescu came in first out of seven, although only with around 21% of the vote. And it looked like he made it into the second round. And it was released by the intelligence community in the country and, with NATO ties, that the reason why he was able to do as well as he did in the first round is that Russia had set up a few tens of thousands of TikTok accounts that boosted him in the electorate. Now, that's not good, and we need to do more in democracies to prevent this kind of meddling, but it is very much soft meddling. This was not an example of ballots being stolen or doctored or and so forth. And for the Constitutional Court to intervene and nullify those results, leaving the country sort of unclear about how to proceed, they now have to hold it again, an election again, and somehow do it without interference from Russia when everyone knows that this has now happened and has actually seems to maybe have given an extra boost to the populace. This just simply cannot be the way that democracies protect themselves against this very formidable challenge they're facing right now. It just, it ends up contributing to the very kind of air of illegitimacy that populists stoke in order to gain in their movements. And so I really am disheartened to see Romania do this. And if you want to learn more and see the full argument against why this is a bad move, I encourage you to read Yasha Monk's very good piece.
Thank you. And Noah Smith.
Well, I think that I already ranted a whole bunch, so I don't want to rant more. But I would like to say that rabbits are the highlight of my week, and that this week I went to play with a rabbit who is half giant, and he is a big friendly rabbit, basically a golden retriever in rabbit form, who will like run right up to you and like snuggle with you and like jump in your lap and like run around with you, etc. And you can pet like a cat, though. And so I would like to say that rabbits are a really underrated pet, easy to litter train, very affectionate. And that if you're interested in trying something new, you should go to your local rabbit rescue and just try petting a couple of them, see if you like them. Also, they're great with cats. Cats love to lick rabbits all day long, and we'll just hug them. And they
have the softest fur.
They really do. And they're quiet. Yeah. They don't make a sound. And they are non-stinky.
This is all to their favor. All right. I have a highlight, which is that this week, we really had a situation of life imitating art, and it made me smile. I don't know how many people who are on this podcast watch Succession. I'm pretty sure Damon did. Linda. Yeah. So the Murdoch family, which, upon whom that series was loosely based, maybe not so loosely, went to court in Nevada to try. It was Lachlan, the eldest of Rupert's sons, and Rupert together were attempting to change an irrevocable trust that they had set up in 1999 that would divide control of the companies upon Rupert's death evenly among his surviving adult children, with the exception of the two youngest from, anyway, it's not, they don't get voting shares. Okay. So they set up this irrevocable trust, and then they tried to change it because Lachlan agrees with Rupert in his right wing politics and the other kids don't. But here's where it gets, into a little bit of a meta situation, because apparently this whole thing got started when one of the representatives of one of the children sent around a memo, having watched the episode of Succession where the patriarch dies, not intestate, but certainly leaving everything uncertain as to who will inherit the company. They said, we have to get busy and figure this out so this doesn't happen to us. And so they wound up in court in Nevada. The fact finder, I think they call him a commissioner. It's sort of complicated with a trust adjudication. But anyway, he found against Rupert and Lachlan, but that will then in turn be reviewed by a judge. And so the story's not over yet, but the fight within the Murdoch family about the destiny of this right-wing media empire is so close to what happened in Succession that it made me shake my head. So for those who are interested, I recommend the show Succession. It was very entertaining. With that, I want to thank our guest, Noah Smith, and our regulars, and of course, our viewers and listeners, and we will return next week as every week.